Napster. This is CBS Eye on the World, Behind the Black. 12 years of Behind the Black's understanding of space engineering to reach the planet Mars and the moon. Well, we've reached the planet Mars. Your donations are most appreciated. And we're now going hang gliding on planet Mars. Yes, you thought it was nothing but rovers and perhaps the flying toaster Ingenuity, but no. Bob Zimmerman is going to tell us how NASA is going to hang glide through a canyon. Is this bigger than Grand Canyon, Bob?
Yes, yes. They're not really doing hang gliders, John, but they're proposing gliders, you know, the little gliding planes, the unpowered flight that, you know, pilots have been using for decades, you know, where they get towed into the air and then released and you can glide, no power, for a very long period of time. They call it also sail planes, and they call the activity soaring sometimes, you know, use the thermals and control flight. It's actually before hang gliding came along. But now some engineers have looked at the atmosphere of Mars and have looked at the technology and the lift capabilities of sail planes and gliders, and they're proposing that we build a sail plane to fly to Mars. And they use as a demonstration mission, two different possible demonstration missions in Valles Marineris, which is the biggest canyon in the solar system. If you put that canyon on top of the United States, it would pretty much fill the entire country. It's gigantic. And so this, and you know, you're talking about elevation differences that are close to 10,000 feet from the floor to the canyon. That's twice as high as the Grand Canyon. And so these sail planes would fly into the canyon and go up and down along the cliff face to study it, as well as zigzag around. They have the other possibility of zigzagging around across the floor of the canyon. And when they land, they can't take off again, but then they become weather stations where they're sitting. And so this is a proposal. They're doing tests. They've done some wind tunnel tests and ground tests. They are now going to try to do some high-altitude tests, 15,000-foot elevation, where they say that kind of closely simulates the atmosphere of Mars at that elevation. And they're going to do some flight tests for that. And that's their proposal. This is another variation on taking advantage of the fact that even though it's a very thin atmosphere on Mars, 1,000th the thickness of Earth, it's there, and you can actually use it. And so that's, and Ingenuity proved that. So now we got gliders coming as well, John.
And gliders and more helicopters as well, right, Bob? They're considered.
That's right.
We can tour Mars from the sky. We don't need to grind along on the rocky bottom. As we see, it damages wheels. We'll eventually have fleets of everything in the air. We're going now to one of the concerns that everyone has about travel to Mars for mankind, which is what happens in space to the human body. We've seen some results from long-term stay on the ISS. This one about bone loss looks profound. What do we know, Bob?
Well, we've known for decades, going back to Skylab back in the early 70s, that being in weightlessness causes a loss of bone density in the weight-bearing bones, especially the hips and the legs and those kind of bones. And so and they've tried all kinds of solutions. In the Soviet era, Russians did a lot of long-term missions and found that they could mitigate somewhat the bone loss by some exercises. Well, they've done now new research on ISS, and scientists have now confirmed what that Soviet era science had learned in the 20th century, that long-term bone loss during long missions in weightlessness can take many months to recover once you return to Earth. And the Russians had found that, you know, for every month you were in space, it would take a month to recover on the ground. And this is what these scientists have now confirmed. The quotes from one scientist: the longer you spend in space, the more bone you lose, and it takes time for the bone to come back. This research found the bone loss was in the range of 1 to 2% per month, which is much higher than the Russians had found. The Russians found generally averaging 5% per, I'm sorry, 0.5% a month, but it also varied from individuals, and it also varied dependent on exercise. And so what they found is that some exercises did not work. Others, such as lifting weights, worked better. And so they need to do something. Now, this problem isn't necessarily going to be debilitating if you get to Mars, because the bone loss in 6 months of flight or 8 months is not enough for your bones to break in the very weak Martian gravity. The other problem is your muscles get weak, and you might not be able to really function well because your body's weak. This is why when astronauts come back from a six-month to a year mission, they initially are carried out of the capsule and sit in lawn chairs for a period of time. They don't walk easily. You won't have that on Mars to help you. You're going to have to function on your own, and this is a problem. And bone loss now tells us we really need to look at some way to start studying simulated gravity at even small amounts. There is one research paper I've come across in my decades of research, John, which said that if you can, with using a centrifuge on a Soviet-era space station, if you just simply give a biology 1% gravity field, that's a very tiny amount of spin in a spacecraft, that mitigated the problems. This was a plant life. We don't know how to work with people, but we need to start doing that research, absolutely.
Bob watches sunspots. Why? Because, well, he can, and also because the predictions tell us we're now headed to a solar maximum. This is beginning to look like a maximum, Bob.
Yes, it does. In the last month, in June, we actually had a slight decline in the number of sunspots during the month. However, the decline didn't bring us even close to the prediction. We're still way over the number of sunspots the predictions had come across. And what's really important about sunspots and the sun is that there's a correlation between high activity of sunspots and a slightly warmer sun. And that correlates with temperature on Earth. If you have a very active sun, the temperature warms up on the Earth. That's been the pattern. If the sun is not very active, as it's been for the last two solar cycles, things cool on the Earth, and that's been the case here. We have not had any global warming for 20 years. And so that's why you study this. At least that's why scientists should be studying this. Unfortunately, they don't, or it's dismissed because they have political concerns instead. But either way, in the last month, sunspots dropped slightly, but right now we're heading to what looks like is going to be a very, very powerful minimum, which is not what the consensus opinion was in the science community. There was one outlier group of scientists who predicted a high solar maximum, and they were the exception, not the rule. They were the deniers, but it seems like they might be right, John.
And Bob, you've got a really cool graphic on Behind the Black of explicating the story of what happens when a rubble pile asteroid is hit by another, an impactor very different than how it happens on the on planets. Explain, please.
Well, all right, let me go quick, John. We've got a lot of time. When a bolide or an object hits a impacts, you expect the ejected material to fly away quite fast, as fast as the object that hit. And you think with a rubble pile, which doesn't have a big gravity, that it would be thrown out away from the asteroid. They found that's not the case. The cohesion of the object is so weak that the objects don't fly very far, and they end up doing landslides instead. Explains how rubble pile asteroids can grow.
It's a very cool graphic on Behind the Black. 12 years of Behind the Black. Your subscriptions and donations are most appreciated. Bob Zimmerman, I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor,